I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
This play was done with the Howland Company, and we are a small, mighty, but resource-strapped organization, and I knew that I couldn't have many scene changes. And so I thought, okay, if the first scene, which I knew I really wanted to see in a kitchen, was going to take place in a kitchen, I was like, how much... how long can we stay there? And the answer was, oh, I think the whole play.
This is Play Me, your digital theater. We transform the hottest contemporary plays into bingeable audio dramas. I'm Laura Mullen.
And I'm Chris Tolley. Welcome to Play Me, the podcast where we turn acclaimed stage plays into captivating audio fiction. In today's episode, we talk to Paolo Santalucia, the writer of the hit play Prodigal, available on Play Me. Hey, Laura.
Hi, Chris. So you were the one who got a chance to sit down and talk to Paolo about his hit play Prodigal. The show explores the dynamics of the Clark family on the eve of when the patriarch, Rowan Clark, is appointed to a coveted new position. And all of this happens as their estranged alcoholic son, Edmund, shows up demanding money to fund his lifestyle, threatening Rowan's new prestigious job. It's an ambitious and highly entertaining play about power and privilege that became a big hit, which isn't surprising considering the caliber of the writing and the performances. But what is surprising is that this was actually Paolo's first play. I wonder, did you guys get a chance to talk about how he managed to pull that off?
I did. And the thing about Paolo is, even though he's actually relatively quite young, he has tremendous experience already in theater. Paolo has a CV like you just wouldn't believe, with accomplishments both as a performer and an artistic leader. So he had great insights not only into this particular play, but also theater as a whole.
Paolo is an award-winning theater artist from Toronto and the current Associate Artistic Director at Crow's Theatre. He's performed in theaters across Canada and the United States, and he co-founded the award-winning Howland Company. Theater critic Glenn Summi named him an artist to watch in 2023, and his play Prodigal was nominated for two Dora Awards, including for Best Original Play.
Paolo and I talked about themes of redemption and class, among others, which can be found throughout Prodigal, as well as the current state of theater and the challenges creators face these days. Here is my interview with Paolo Santalucia. Paolo, thank you so much for joining me. And I'd just like to say thank you for giving us an opportunity to make Prodigal part of our season. It's such an incredibly well-written show. And it's a surprise, I think, to many that this is your first show that you've written. Mm-hmm. But of course, that doesn't totally tell the story because you do have an awful lot of experience behind you. You're a very accomplished performer. You've been part of the Soul Pepper Ensemble for many years. And you're currently the Associate Artistic Director of Crow's. Can you tell us a little bit about that journey that took you from performer to playwright?
It's a really great question. I feel so lucky that in my, my theatrical upbringing that I was, you know, I trained at Soul Pepper for a couple of years before I was sort of a member of the acting ensemble there for about 11 seasons. And the thing that I feel I really took away from those experiences were that, you know, that company at the time, especially, and it still is very much driven by plays, and the play is at the center of the work, and the artists kind of coalesce around a work that they are excited and inspired to bring to life and to activate in as full a way as they possibly can. And I feel very lucky, I think, that in my very early training, there wasn't a huge distinction between If you were a designer, you were still making a play. If you were a stage manager, you were still involved in making a play. If you were an actor, you were involved in making a play. If you're a director, you're involved in making a play, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that ultimately, like, I was able to inherit a value system that was really play-centric and really invested in the actualization of art that everyone was compelled to be making at the highest level that they could. And as a result, I think that it was really just gumption. It was really just sort of as I got more excited by the work that I got to be doing as a performer, there were other elements to the storytelling and other elements to playmaking that really sort of became exciting to me. And because I was brought up in a setting that allowed me to embrace those facets of myself and I was supported in those ways, I was, you know, naive, stupid, foolish enough to ask for those supports and was very privileged to be provided them. And so I feel like it was really, for me, the more I kind of process my interest in the craft, I realize that it's all just an extension of the same singular intention, which is that I love theater. Yes. And some stories I feel now very compelled to be a part of as a performer. There's others that I feel my entry point is maybe that more by way of a director. And then there's sort of slowly starting to foray into what it is to be to also be giving voice to them in a different way. And so that's sort of where I think the impetus came from. But it's really just, you know, the simple answer is I love plays. And and it's so silly to say that, but it's really true.
I can see that. And I remember when we were recording there in the studio, you were directing and it really did feel like a collaboration. People would stop. They would say, this doesn't quite feel right, or how is this going to work? And then everybody would sort of sit around and work it all out.
Yeah, I generally feel that it's important to the making of something that 10 voices are better than one. I think it's, you know, again, symptomatic of the fact that I was really lucky to be sort of training in an ensemble rep company where we were in shows that had 12 to 15 people all the time. And just the ability to observe how valuable that was to an artistic process. And I really, like, I really don't even consider myself like a writer, and I'm putting that in air quotes in this in this interview, because it's, you know, I know like one play does not a writer make. And this was a story that I was really compelled to try to bring to the fore. And I'm so blessed that I had the talented individuals involved around me who made it what it was, because without them, it would have withered on the vine.
I know you also work with Kat Sandler. You were in Mustard, and she's, of course, very famous for being in the room all the time as a writer and making changes and working with the cast. So I can see how that really is the kind of work that you're attracted to. And you also were famously in Soulpepper's production of Bed and Breakfast. And we also recorded Bed and Breakfast with a different cast. We re-recorded it with Mark, who is the playwright, and his real-life partner, Paul. But you were in the show with your real-life partner, Gregory. So you have quite a pedigree when it comes to performing. So I'm curious, as somebody who has so much experience, let's be honest, you're young, but you have experience way beyond your years. So based on what you've seen, has theater and have theater audiences changed over the years?
Mm-hmm. It's a great question. And bless you for saying that I'm young.
it's all relative, right?
Thank you so much. Thank you. It's a really good question. I think that, yes, I think the short answer is yes. You know, the pandemic, you know, I know nobody wants to talk about these things, but it had a huge impact, I think, on the way that we consume art, theater, and every institution is suffering and is still suffering. You know, very, very few places have returned to sort of pre-pandemic levels of engagement from their patrons. I think there's a number of factors as to why that's true. But I think more and more what the pandemic really solidified for a lot of people is how we, first of all, everything's really expensive right now. Yeah. And I think just, and I hope it's clear that in no way do I sort of, there's no judgment on anyone who's listening who hasn't been to a play in a while, and this is the way that you consume art. Yeah. Thank heaven you do. Yeah. But, you know, certainly I think we're competing with the couch in a way that we weren't for a long time. And I noticed that even in myself now, the way in which I'm much more risk averse in my time. And I think that the pandemic, I think that's ultimately what it comes down to, is that time has become a resource that people quantify as much as they do any other element of their kind of immediate circumstances. I feel like the amount of times now we engage or try to make plans or try to move forward, even in my, never mind the theater sphere, just in my social sphere. And you hear people say, I'm just so busy. I'm so busy. I'm so busy. And I think downtime is becoming something that people really tapped into in the last 3 years, and how they fuel and how they use that time and where they spend their, the commodification of that time is different now than it was in 2020. I think that, and I think theaters, I think any, I think movie theaters are suffering for it too. I think any kind of live entertainment sphere where it used to be, you might have individuals who are able to come and interested in coming to 4 or 5 plays a season. Maybe they come to 2 now.
Yes.
And, that realignment of their own interests is totally, totally understand it and totally recognize it. But I do feel like you now more than ever really have to give folks a reason to, turn off Netflix and come to the theater. And I actually think that that's awesome for theater. I think that that's actually so exciting. When I think of the amount of amazing work that I have seen in the last 3 years, I think it is causing companies to have to necessitate engaging with projects in different ways. I think that the projects that they are engaging with are also being sort of forced to adapt and be more representative of the kind of work I think that audiences are really excited by. And I think when that happens, the ways in which companies and cultural institutions that I think are trying to be the forefront of those conversations, the way that those institutions have to engage with the public and really demand their attention and articulate why theater matters, why theater is a vital, blood-pumping, necessary element of any major city, I think that just breeds good work.
It seems to be almost like a muscle that maybe collectively we stopped exercising that muscle, and now it's going to take a little while to get to build up the strength again.
Totally. And like TV is really good now. Like it's, you know, there's lots of things. Like it's, I think the restaurant industry is feeling this in its own kind of way, you know, like people became really good at, you know, staying home and cooking up amazing things. Like what people discovered about their home life and the way that they can absorb and consume, sort of really beautiful curated experiences for themselves without having to leave their immediate sphere. I think every cultural organization has to engage with this question. And I think it's making, I think it will actually make everything more exciting.
Yeah. It's hard. It's hard to leave your kitchen these days.
It is.
You know, absolutely. You know, that kind of brings me to Prodigal, in that you set your show in a kitchen, and that was a very deliberate choice. You didn't put it in a dining room. You didn't put it in the bedroom. It's in the kitchen. Can you talk a little bit about why that setting?
The really boring answer is this play was done with the Howland Company, and we are a small, mighty, but resource-strapped organization, and I knew that I couldn't have many scene changes. And so I thought, okay, if the first scene, which I knew I really wanted to see in a kitchen, was going to take place in a kitchen, I was like, how much... how long can we stay there? And the answer was, oh, I think the whole play. So that's the really boring answer. But I, like, thematically, I thought really hard about... I've always been really interested in plays about class and plays about class structure and comedies about class and comedies about class structure. And I really was sort of thinking about, you know, where in the home, like where still remains the one place in which all of these characters actually would have a reason to be in the same room. And the reality was there was no other room, I think, in which all of these individuals would be present for one another. I also love to cook. I also love being in the kitchen. And I was really excited about opening the play with sort of a high stakes scenario in which a cook was sort of needing to manage her own conflicted relationships with her employers as she tried to negotiate that. Because it also felt like, you know, I think you learn a lot about I don't know if you've experienced this, but you learn a lot about people, the way they treat wait staff. You learn a lot about folks, the way that they engage in those spheres. And I thought that what a juicy, exciting setting in which to learn about this family by not meeting them for about half an hour.
Yeah. And you have the elite of the elite of Canada right there at a dinner party, but they're in the other room. You just hear them through the wall.
Yeah. And I think that there's, you know, you're tapping into sort of like this play has a little bit of, you know, there's of course, there's undercurrents of like secrecy and all of those things. And I think that in lots of homes with at this level of this echelon of society, that's a room that's probably like less traversed than a lot of places. So I was also trying to think about like what room in the house would there be in which, actually these secrets could unfold. And the kitchen was a place that I thought made a lot of sense.
And also, you know, it's a lot about class as mm-hmm. well, in that, you know, I love the moment when Marilyn couldn't figure out coffee.
Yes. You know? Yes.
And that says so much.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's some of my favorite plays, and I think we're driven, like we love it. We love Succession. It's why we love Succession. It's why we love shows like Succession. It's like, you know, Succession to me is successful because the same reasons that Molière is successful. It's because we cannot help but be interested a little bit in lifting the veil and finding humor in elements of our own class structure mm-hmm. that a lot of times we might not have as direct access to as we want, but we're certainly informed by. And, you know, I was very, very lucky and very privileged to have grown up in the city and my whole life, and to have lived here my whole life, and to have met such incredible people throughout my entire time here. And, you know, a scene like that for me is building a little bit off of what I think makes so many great plays successful, is that you watch like really important, powerful individuals also kind of be a little bit less adept in the domestic sphere of their own life as maybe they should be given who they are.
Yeah.
And that trope is, I think, what drives so much comedy, social commentary comedy. And I was really drawing from, I think, a series of sort of dramaturgical values that I love and have sort of been growing up loving. It's what makes, all of those comedies great. And it's why I think it's sort of the driving force behind why we're really attached to sort of like eat the rich narratives right now.
And it also, it just demonstrates the contrast between the people off stage and the people in the kitchen. You know, mm-hmm. you have Pauline, who is in total control of herself and her space, mm-hmm. and her relationship is built based on mutual respect. And then you've got the people in the other room who have very little self-control mm-hmm. and very little self-awareness.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that's the thing, is that it's also a very human. It's really important to me that the undertaking of class in this play, that we understand that a character like Pauline, who is arguably one of the most disenfranchised individuals in the piece, not just in terms of her struggle and the complexity with which she's engaging with the situation that she's in, that we see the ways in which these systems of power are just inherent in kind of just everyday actions. It's why it was important to me that we have a moment where Marilyn actually can't, you know, make that coffee. And that for me is actually a bit more indicative, a bit more of a metaphorized version of the fact that she's actually not a good, she has difficulty providing.
Yeah.
That's the core struggle of what it is that she's going through. It's not, I think, you know, it's which is a very human thing, that her kind of the overarching struggle for Marilyn in the play is that she is at odds with her desire to connect with her children, to provide for her children, and she's constantly vilified for never being good enough as a woman, as a mother, as a wife. She's at the center of a marriage that is failing, and knows it. And so, yes, there's a certain element of social commentary maybe in that moment about the coffee, but it's also, I think, really indicative of what happens when even Marilyn is caught up in that moment, that she's not in control either of her circumstances to a certain degree. And I think that, you know, it was important to me writing the play that we find sympathy in that, in these individuals, yeah. that it's not, this isn't about they are bad people because, simply because of their status. And there are other characters who are not simply good people because of their status, that there is conflict at play kind of across the board. You know, Simone has a very complicated relationship with her brother's homosexuality. Yeah. And it's not a given that that relationship is going to survive the events of the play.
Yeah.
She is compromising, and at the same time that she has a complicated relationship with those things, she is also compromising her own value systems in order to capitalize on opportunity, on love, on something that's occurring between her and Rowan. And so for me, it was really exciting to sort of try to create a series of threads over the play that allowed all of these characters to find moments in which they could compromise themselves and their own value systems, their own belief systems. And sometimes that's absolutely rooted in class, but most of the time it's actually rooted, I think, for me, in the kind of the quote unquote roles that we are supposed to fulfill based on the ways in which all of these systems tell us the way that we're supposed to operate in the world.
Yeah.
And Marilyn is as much a victim of that as others, for very different reasons. And she's empowered to divorce herself from those situations and is able to in different ways, but still trying to find little moments where we could highlight and illustrate the ways in which something as simple as making a cup of coffee could reinforce the fact that her children think she's an awful mother.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, it wasn't until you just started to talk about this that it made me think, really, none of the women are acknowledged for their contribution. And yet Marilyn's not a great mom because she loves her trees more than she loves her children, or she can care for her trees more than she can care, but she's still doing the best she can, and she's being the best mom she can, but she's not recognized for that contribution. And you know, that goes through really all the women characters as well.
Yeah. And you know, her daughter is her daughter's no saint.
Yeah.
And that's also, it's also important. I mean, it's to me to illustrate that those characters are all still ultimately, I mean, Rowan is at the center of the play. Rowan's power is at the center of the play. I mean, that's very deliberate. And the ramifications and the consolidation of that power are ultimately, and I guess the ways in which the events spiral outwardly from him as a white man at the center of a very prominent family about to inherit a very significant position. And that mutes a lot of voices, that mutes a lot of agency. And it was important to me that the play looked at that, or tried to look at that, across as many, as large a swath as possible.
That's interesting, because achievement really does seem to be such a central element in this piece. Everybody's trying to achieve something, or they're not recognized for their achievement. Why did you decide to really focus on this? And I have to preface this, I've talked about you and I've used the word achievement a lot. So I'm wondering if there's a connection from you and why you wanted to explore.
It's such an interesting, it's so funny because I actually haven't, it's really probably rooted in my really basic interest in theater, which is just that, you know, my favorite plays are plays in which people pursue what they want.
Yeah.
And the higher and more lofty the goal, the more drama that can kind of ensue. And I think that, you know, when I think of my favorite plays, my favorite writers, my ability to discern sort of what the like objective view of the playwright is often mitigated by how badly characters want things.
Yeah.
And I think that's such an important tenet to playmaking. I think that's such an important element to sort of undertaking plays in which, again, to go back to what I was saying earlier about compromise and the way that characters compromise one another, that or compromise themselves, that in order to set up a series of circumstances in which I feel like those characters could potentially have to work against things that they believed were values that made them who they were, their wants had to be high enough that they were willing to do things at any cost. Yeah. And so I think that's why achievement is maybe in this play to the degree that it is, because I felt like the goals, I was super self-conscious. Like, am I really writing a play about like governor generalship? Like what? But you know, it had to be, Rowan had to be in the middle of a huge opportunity for me in order to kind of have a life have the potential for there to be a life altering moment in his life. And that's where it started. And as soon as that was in the middle of the play, then you kind of go, okay, well, if the governor generalship is on the table, then like we can kind of go wherever we want. Pauline can want a restaurant. You know, Edmund can want his father's love. Like we can, you know, it kind of laid the groundwork. And so it really was just about me trying to find context in which the wants were big enough that the characters could reach sort of really critical thresholds of compromise.
Yeah. Edmund's such a character that you just can't help but love. And I think my feeling, at least what I take away from it as an audience member, is it's because he's just so vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And while everybody's fighting for their own, whether it's a writing career or, you know, the governor generalship or your own restaurant, he says, and I think he kind of in a sense believes, that he is worthless. Mm-hmm. What's going on with his character there?
Like, from the outset with Edmund was really trying to, I mean, one of the main reasons I wanted to write this play was because I was actually kind of like reflecting, at least during the pandemic, about, you know, there's a lot of variables that go into the shaping of someone's relationship to their own identity. And Edmund was somebody, I think, for me, that represented the potential for us to be reminded a little bit of the fact that, like, just because he is a vulnerable gay man trying to survive his family doesn't excuse the fact that he's also volatile and has the capacity for great harm. And I very deliberately, and, you know, over many permeations of the play, struggled with whether the catalyst for his sort of expulsion from the family needed to be named or not, whether, you know, there needed to be a singular event named in the play or not, and was really self-conscious about the fact that, I mean, I think I know for myself what that is, but it's not in the play.
Yeah.
It's not part of his explicit story. And that for me was something that I think, I guess really catalyzed my interest in the fact that Edmund can both be vulnerable, gay, a victim of his family's rejection.
Yeah.
And yet that can be completely separate from the fact that he is also potentially a volatile, terrible son. and that those facts of his life aren't a calling card to why he is the way he is. They could be. They absolutely could be. But at a certain point, you know, He's not 19. He's in his 30s. And so, you know, at a certain point, one's ability to change their life for the better has to rest on them. Yeah. And so that's where I guess I was really interested in taking that character, and in terms of us, you know, both, as when I say us, I mean the public, like, you know, we can't help, I think, but be absolutely absorbed in his wit, in his sense of humor, in his sexuality, like all of those things that make him, I think, kind of an intoxicating individual in the theater. Yeah. And yet at the same time, I hope that we also still struggle somewhat with the fact that he, if what he wants is love from his parents, ultimately, there are probably other ways in which he can express that.
Yeah.
And he chooses none of them. So, and that's deliberate. And so I really wanted to, I'm really inspired. Like, I'm so lucky, you know, I'm really inspired by, I think there's the plethora of really incredible queer writers. When I think back to like Edward Albee on the American side, but I also think of like Morris Panitch. I think of Daniel McIver. I think of these writers who I think I have been so shaped by in terms of my own, even before I knew what it was to be a queer person, I was intoxicated by the ways in which those characters that were represented in their plays were so complicated, were always in conflict with what it was that they did based on who they were. And that always there seemed to be great tension in their trying to reconcile and wrestle with the fact that they both felt like they were sometimes at the very bottom rung of whatever ladder they were. And at the same time, were trying to exert great power over the circumstances around them to feel like more, like just to be fuller people in the world. And that tension for me, I think, is like something that I think is really, I really identify with as a gay man, and was definitely something that I wanted to put into Edmund's story.
You create, I think, for the audience, this such the strong desire to want to save him and just say you're loved, right? Mm-hmm. And you want mm-hmm. the dad to say, you want everybody to say, you want to say it as an audience member, and yet everybody has a block mm-hmm. and prevents them from
totally
doing that.
And like, how blessed, like that vulnerability. Congratulations, Dan Musso, to like, you know, really none of these people exist without the actors who play them. And it was such a gift to learn from what Dan was doing, also like what the roots of that vulnerability are and how deep they could go, because I learned from what we were finding in rehearsal about where just how far back those roots could take him.
That's so very true. Dan is very much like that. He's an incredibly confident performer, but also he's a vulnerable person as well. I'm Chris Tolley here with Paolo Santalucia, and we're talking about his play, Prodigal. We'll be right back right after this. There is...
I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of 6 darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. You understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
One word in this play that I think so much of it just hangs on. And in fact, it's the last word of the play, mm-hmm. and the word is sorry. And I'm wondering if you can just sort of unpack that a little bit and talk a little bit about redemption and mm-hmm. forgiveness and the word sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I really didn't know when I was starting the play that this thread of apology was necessarily going to be as sort of central to my engagement with the story as it was. But I think the more that I got into it and the more I kind of was really looking at Edmund and at Rowan and sort of looking at these two men, both of whom I think felt for different reasons like they had a lot to apologize for, and both of them looking for ways in which that they could be forgiven for the things that they were doing. The more I realized that I was in fact actually writing a play that was looking at people who were, whose morality or sense of morality was still kind of like really at the forefront of their actions. And then I thought, well, that's really exciting. That's a really exciting place to have people who are so constantly compromising themselves, actually, and like quite aware of the fact that they are. Yeah. And I think Edmund is someone who's like very much driven by his past, and Rowan is now faced with the implications of his future. Whose job is it to forgive Edmund? Whose job is it to say, you know, Edmund was entitled to undertake the kinds of harm, the acts of harm that he undertakes in this play because of the fact of who he is? Is he entitled to those actions? Yeah. Is Rowan saying I'm sorry at the end of the play enough to forgive what he's done? And I think for me, it was really important to end the play with Marilyn and Rowan, and to kind of observe her final act, that the final act in the play, I actually think, is one of love, in which, you know, she and Nancy and I talked a lot about this, about, you know, whether she knows what she knows, how much she knows, and the fact that she extends the invitation for him to return to her bed, as ultimately an act of love.
Yeah.
And that at the, actually the root of this, at the root of this home, there is love, that they are a family that has always found a way to love each other, mm-hmm. despite all the rest of it. And it was important to me that that came from Marilyn. It was important yeah. to me that, that the women in the play are the ones ultimately who are the ones to say, to express those ways of care. And that was important.
You know, Rowan finally says, "I'm sorry," mm-hmm. to Edmund, but if he's in an empty room, mm-hmm. it's like, yeah. is it really an apology yeah. when you say it by yourself yeah. when no one's around? Yeah.
And it's interesting even that you say that he's saying it to Edmund, because it is ambiguous. You
yeah. know?
I think that
that's
true.
Could
be saying it. I yeah. mean, the gesture ultimately was, who is he saying it to? Is he saying it to
yeah,
Simone? Is
true.
He saying it to his wife? Is he saying it to his son? Is he saying it to his other son? Is he saying it yeah. to his daughter? Is he saying it to all of them? Like, yeah. you know.
That is such a good point, because, of course, I just assumed he was apologizing to Edmund. But mm-hmm. but no, of course, like, it could be anybody. And that's also what makes that moment just such an incredible moment, which is it becomes sort of like a Rorschach test.
Mm-hmm.
Before we go, I just want to talk to you as the associate artistic director of Crows and a lot of theater companies. It's a challenging time mm-hmm. for them. It really is a very challenging time for theater companies. And there are a number of companies that are doing incredibly well also. Crows, I think, is a perfect example. Mm-hmm. You're selling out shows, you're extending runs of shows, and obviously, it's because the work that you're producing is really good and people want to come and see it.
Kind of, like, you say.
That's kind of obvious. But I think there's a little bit more to it as well. And I'm just wondering, is there something that you're tapping into or that you're focusing on that, if you could share, really help the whole community as a whole?
I think we are experiencing a really exciting season this year. And I think that there's sort of two parts to that. I mean, one ultimately is... we're as thrilled and surprised by it as anybody, you know, that it's not to say that there aren't deliberate things that we're trying to do, but we aren't taking it for granted. We're so grateful to the fact that people are interested in making the trek over to Dundas and Carlaw yeah. To checking out the work that's happening there. But I do think that part of the governing principle, in a way that, like, I think both Chris and I try to engage with when it comes to the programming, when it comes to the work, is that we really do believe that the theater has to remain a place in which we can go as a community to bear witness to stories, to experiences that have the power to change and reshape the way we think about the world. And I know that sounds huge, mm-hmm. but it kind of is, you know, that as I said at the beginning of this, you know, if we're competing with the couch right now, which I think we are in a big way,
yeah.
the only way to get people into the theater is to make the theater a place where experience can happen.
Yeah.
And people aren't averse to experience. I think that's what we've really learned from this year, that people will come if what is occurring within the four walls of that containered space is something that has a little bit of potential to alter their DNA, no. you know, and that can be in really profound ways. That can also just be laughter. Yeah. That can also just be a place where you can release your day, release the things that are, you know, or ask you to re-engage with something that actually you feel quite passionately about in a way that elucidates humor or whatever. And I think ultimately right now we are trying really hard to hold ourselves accountable to experience.
Well, you guys are certainly hitting it out of the park, that's for sure. So congratulations on all the work. And I have to say, what a joy it was to talk to you. Thank you so much for sharing so much. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me. Such a pleasure.
That was Paolo Santalucia talking about his show, Prodigal, which is available now on Play Me. We'll return next with writer-performer Diane Flax's latest solo show, Guilt, A Love Story. Part stand-up, part confessional, Guilt takes us on an odyssey through infidelity, divorce, forgiveness, and love. Thanks for listening.
We'd love to know what you think about Play Me. You can connect with us by emailing playme@cbc.ca. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to Play Me wherever you get your podcasts. By subscribing, you can listen to all our past shows, and you won't miss a single one of our new episodes. And while you're there, we would love it if you would consider rating and reviewing us. It helps spread the word about our podcast, bringing theater to a whole new audience. Play Me is produced by Laura Mullen and Chris Tolley in partnership with CBC Podcasts. Our associate producer is Brianne Tice. A special thanks to our CBC team. Anna Achete is our digital producer, and our executive producer is Cecil Fernandez.
The director of CBC Podcasts is Arif Narani, and the executive director is Leslie Merklinger.
Play Me is funded by the Canada Council for the Arts and the Ontario Arts Council. Play Me is an Expect Theatre production. For more information about our plays, please visit playmepodcast.com.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.